In his moving TEDx talk, John Sutherland, who's an officer in London's police department, explains a principle in forensic science that's called Locar's exchange. Developed by Dr. Edmond Locar, known as the Sherlock Holmes of France, this principle has a very simple premise. Every contact leaves a trace. In other words, every criminal leaves a trace behind him. One forensic expert put it this way: wherever he steps, whatever he touches, whatever he leaves, even unconsciously, will serve as a silent witness against him. Not only his fingerprints or his footprints, but his hair, the fibers from his clothes, the glass he breaks, the paint he scratches, the blood he deposits or collects. This is evidence that does not forget. Sutherland explains how this principle, though, applies not just to forensic science, but to all of human relationships. He says this: every time two people come into contact with one another, an exchange takes place, whether between lifelong friends or passing strangers. We encourage, we ignore. We hold out a hand or we withdraw it. We walk towards or we walk away. We bless or we curse. And every single contact leaves a trace. The way we treat and regard one another matters. It really matters. I think Sutherland is explaining something deep and universal, something that Thomas touches on in John chapter 20. In his need to touch Jesus in order to believe in the resurrection. And Thomas also, without knowing it, I think, is saying something important about how we touch one another. In the end, Jesus touches him with the restoration of his faith in the midst of that community. We're in the season of Easter. And we're seeing how the risen Christ is encountered and known in the various accounts that we have in the scriptures. Last week, it was Mary Magdalene at the empty tomb. She was the first one to see Jesus alive and the first to share that news. This week, it's the gathered disciples and also Thomas. Next week, it's Simon Peter and some of the other disciples. And you know, this is one of the important features of how the Gospels come to us, isn't it? They share about Jesus in a very personal way. They're particular. They give us details. They're revealing not just about the person of Jesus himself, but of those around him. And because of that, we're invited into the narrative. These are people that we can understand and relate to. Sometimes they struggle. Sometimes they triumph. They're fearful, but they can also be courageous. They sin, but they experience the mercy and forgiveness of God. They doubt, and they believe. This particular chapter, John chapter 20, is a personal favorite of mine, and I have to say, maybe even in all the New Testament, the one chapter that I would say, if someone says, do you have a favorite? I don't usually do that kind of thing, but for today, let's say yes. And it's because in such a short span of time, we witness an amazing transformation from brokenness to wholeness, from fear to peace, from those in need of forgiveness to those who are called to offer it to others, from unbelief to trust and faith. And why? Well, it's because the risen Jesus shows up and he offers to each one the gifts of his resurrection. So we're going to talk a little bit about the gifts of the resurrection here in John chapter 20. The first gift is peace. Peace. I mean, these disciples are deeply fearful and anxious, aren't they? I mean, the doors to the room are locked. They've heard the reports of the empty tomb, and I think that, you know, it's a little hopeful there, but they're not sure what to make of them. All they know for sure is Jesus is dead. They saw that. They saw it with their own eyes. They know the trauma of witnessing Jesus' torture and crucifixion, even if they watch from a distance. And for all they know, they're next. They're full of confusion and anxiety, but also guilt. They're a pretty jittery group. And into that locked, nervous room, Jesus appears. And he offers his peace to them. Now, this isn't just a greeting, like, peace, man, or, you know, hey, guys. It's the gift of wholeness. It's the gift of restoration, a blessing for things as they were meant to be. I think actually it resonates with the declarations of God at the very creation of the world, it's good. God made and then declared, it's good. As one of my priest friends likes to say to me, it's all good. It's all good. It's a word of what has been accomplished through the resurrection, of what has been set in motion, of what will be, and what is already in play. It is shalom. Things are complete. They're in harmony. They are well. Jesus, Messiah, is bringing to his disciples and through them to the world the reality of shalom that resonates through the Torah, the Old Testament scriptures. In his book, Not the Way It's Supposed to Be, A Breviary of Sin, author Cornelius Plantinga describes the Old Testament concept of shalom. And I'd like just to read the paragraph that he gives in the book. He says, the webbing together of God, humans, and all creation in justice, fulfillment, and delight is what the Hebrew prophets call shalom. We call it peace, but it means far more than mere peace of mind or a ceasefire between enemies. In the Bible, shalom means universal flourishing, wholeness, and delight, a rich state of affairs in which natural needs are satisfied and natural gifts fruitfully employed. A state of affairs that inspires joyful wonder as its creator and savior opens doors and welcomes the creatures in whom he delights. Shalom, in other words, is the way things ought to be. Jesus isn't just saying to them, don't be afraid. He's announcing and he's offering to them that they can know life as it is meant to be. The life that God gives. The life of the resurrection, this new life. Jesus offers shalom to them because he is shalom. Ephesians tells us that Jesus himself is our peace. In Isaiah, he is the Prince of Peace. And through the cross and the resurrection, he has become peace, and he offers it in all of its dimensions. Graham Cole calls God the peacemaker, who brings shalom through the work of atonement. So there's a lot of rich stuff here, as Jesus steps in the room and says, peace. It's very deep. He actually offers his peace twice, doesn't he? They were a needy bunch, as are we. There's a whole sermon there about offering peace twice, which I'll save, or maybe you could write it this week. I think about the man who's healed, but he's not fully healed. Remember that Jesus heals his vision, but he still can't see clearly? I'm glad for those stories in the New Testament. Sometimes it takes a while. So he offers his peace twice. But between those two blessings, what does he do? He shows them his wounds. Jesus is risen. His body is glorified. Death was undone, and yet the wounds remain. Dr. Stephen Roy addresses this in his book, What God Thinks When We Fail. And these disciples, I mean, let's be honest, they had just come through a major fail. And Dr. Roy says this, Jesus' point in showing his wounds, I believe, was that the peace he was offering was a costly peace. Not costly to these disciples, but supremely costly to Jesus. It cost him his life. Roy says this is a price paid with love. It's a rich and costly peace. So Jesus' first gift is he brings this peace, this deep, flourishing, well-meaning, things are well. Things are as they were meant to be. But Jesus also gives them and offers them the gift of holy community. Now, this is more implied than explicit, but I think you'll see it here. Because in the giving of the Spirit and the commission to forgive others, or not, Jesus is binding them together in his new life, in this life of the resurrection. It's a kind of Pentecost, really, isn't it, here in the Gospel of John, where they're gifted and they're called and they're sent into the world. But here they are healed of their disunity. They're healed of the fracturing of the community that took place around Jesus' betrayal and crucifixion. They were sheep scattered, each to his own way. But in this room, on the evening of the resurrection, Jesus restores them. He gives them his life, and he makes them one, and he puts forgiveness at the heart of things. God is the source of sacred community. And we can only know that, true community as we're constituted by the Spirit of God and called together and held together in him. It's not our idea. In fact, we often go our own way. But John 20 is about wholeness. It's about healing and joy, not just for each one, but for all of them together. In Revelation, we read today that Christ has made us to be a kingdom and priests to serve God. It's Christ's act. We are made to be that. Peter writes that once we were not a people, but now we are a people. We're the people of God. And this is not our doing. It is God who knits us together by his Spirit. Henri Nouwen says there are two disciplines needed for Christian community in order for it to be healthy and flourishing. And the two things are forgiveness and celebration. Forgiveness and celebration. Forgiveness because we're broken and we often don't get it right and we do hurt one another. And celebration because in community we celebrate each other and the gifts that we bring. We don't always get those things right, but we want to. We want to walk together in good and healthy ways. And for now, and when we know this holy community and we walk in forgiveness and celebration, then we're led to ministry together. It flows in that way. We don't go out on our own. We go together in humility and vulnerability, in openness, in forgiveness and love, learning to trust God together and the places that he's leading. And often that's not easy. Nouwen says, if you want a definition of community, I'll give you one. He says, community is the place where the person you least want to live with always lives. But that's how God has made us to be as his people, in community, committed to him and to one another. And we see forgiveness, and we see celebration, and we see this call to unified ministry in this episode in John's Gospel. So first we have the gift of peace, and then we have the gift of this holy community. You know, I think community may be the most important element of spiritual growth for the Christian. I really do. Because, you know, if you want to grow as a Christian, then make sure you're committed in Christian community, because it's here we'll be challenged, but it's also where we'll be loved and affirmed and celebrated. But it's a journey, too. I don't think we really grow as Christians on our own. Now, solitude's important, and that time alone with God to learn and listen to God's voice and so on. But we bring that into community, then. We say, this is what I'm hearing. What are you hearing? You know, would you give witness to that or not? But this is what I think God is leading us in. Do we all see that? And it's a discipline. I mean, it's costly sometimes. Community is very important. And then we see one more gift here. Actually, there are a number of gifts, but one more I want to touch on, and that is the gift of faith, especially as we look at Thomas. You know, Thomas isn't with them that evening, right? For whatever reason, he's absent. Probably good reasons. But he misses the giving of the peace. He misses the presence of Jesus. He misses the breath of the Spirit. He misses the commission to forgive. He misses all of it. So that when he does hear about it, he declares he doesn't believe it and he won't believe it. Not unless he can touch Jesus himself and touch those wounds. See, all of a sudden, Thomas is in a very different place than all the rest of the disciples. They've had an experience that he has not had. I have some sympathy for Thomas because I suspect I would have a very similar response. And we're kind of hard on Thomas, aren't we? Doubting Thomas. He's also the declaring Thomas, the worshiping Thomas. But I think I would say the same thing if they came to me and said, hey, this thing you can't even imagine happened, and I wasn't there and I missed it. I would say, what were you guys drinking or smoking or whatever? I mean, I might not say it quite that way. But Thomas was traumatized just like the others, but here he was on his own. Now, that could have been the end of the story for Thomas, actually. It could be we just never heard of him again. But thankfully, he did something that was important, and that is he remained with the community. And it was that which enabled him to know the healing and transforming presence of the risen Christ. He stayed with them. He was with them when Jesus next appears. He was in a very different place from the others in terms of his thinking and his experience, but he did belong. He did belong. In some ways, he didn't fit, but he did belong. Thomas comes to know the risen Jesus in the midst of the community. And I really believe that's how we're healed and transformed. It's how we come to know the Lord most fully. In community, where we've made commitments, where we know forgiveness and celebration. We need solitude, yes. Not isolation, we need solitude. But the effect of solitude is that it brings us to community. It enables us to commit to one another. And that's not easy sometimes. But I think that's where we'll know the maturing work of God in our lives. I feel like I can talk about this because I've personally struggled with community my whole life. I know part of that's my story, a lot of moving around and so on, but I have to tell you that I'm the first person to peel away from something, really, or to hide my true feelings and thoughts so that others won't judge me. Community has been a constant desire of mine and yet something that I've run from. I think it's why God has placed me as a shepherd of a church where community is such a high value and he has kept me here. You know, I was the sheep always kind of on the edge, like, I don't know, you know. God said, I'll fix him, I'll make him the shepherd. I'm not fixed, but it's a journey. I've learned, I think, and I've grown in this, but it's still something I have to give attention to. Susan says, I'm not a penguin. I don't like to put on the uniform and march in step with everyone else, right? And really, I think we have a community of people. I think we have a church of people like that. Maybe not everybody, right? But there is that, and I get it. But I've learned that fitting in is the opposite of belonging. What I mean is this, because fit is important at some level. But if I try to fit in by adapting or hiding, in other words, I'm just not going to say anything. I'm just going to be quiet, just going to be a chameleon. If that's my approach in community, I will never belong. Belonging comes when we make commitments to community and we show up with honesty and vulnerability. And we're willing to work things out over the long haul. I mean, Thomas does this, doesn't he? He's like, I'm with you guys, but you're, no, I'm not believing it, no. Yet he knew he was with them. He knew he belonged. Community can be painful. But often when it is, it's doing its deepest work in me. It's shaping and transforming like iron sharpening iron. We need one another. It's like marriage. That's a community that I can address for a minute. Susan and I this year will be married 38 years. People say to me, what is the secret to a long and happy marriage? And of course, I'm a little tempted to say, I think those are two answers, two different things. The secret is deciding to have a long and happy marriage, and deciding every day, and deciding every moment. Now, sometimes things do break down, and there's abuse, there's neglect, there's infidelity, all reasons that marriages can end and do. But I think if both are saying, no, we're making this decision every day and continuing to make it, then that's what it's about. That's what it's about. I often preach in marriages and weddings that we have the thought that love will protect our marriage. And I really think it's the other way around. Marriage protects our love. Susan gave me permission to talk about some of the hard times in our marriage, but I'm not going to go there. I just want you to know that they're there. And sometimes years of struggle and difficulty. But I end up in the same place at the end of every day together. And that's good. That's important. But see, it's choice. Community is choice. It really is. It's not easy. It's not. It really is a choice. A real Christian community has room for difference and variety, even doubt and questions, like Thomas's. Thomas brought that openly, right? He discovered faith and trust in the resurrection because he didn't hide, but also because he didn't run away. A loving and healthy and strong community is the best place to process doubt and uncertainty and questions. And I'm convinced that we find faith and wholeness primarily in the company of one another, and that we all long for community but are afraid of it at the same time, afraid of what it might cost. Community does not force us to be like each other, but it does help us all to be like Jesus together. In the end, the greatest gift in John 20 that's offered to the community of disciples and offered to us is the gift of Jesus himself. He's present whenever the community gathers, whenever the community of believers gathers in his name. He's in our midst. He's bringing peace. He's bringing healing and transformation. He brings his resurrection life to us. And he calls us by name and he sends us. You see, we're touched by Jesus and we gain capacity and love to touch each other and to touch the world. And when we experience that, like Thomas, then we are led to worship, to declare the glories of God, like Psalm 150. And we can say, Alleluia, he is risen. Amen.